Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by our super producer, Noel, the best damn garage in town, Brown.
That's a long nickname.
But this is a very special episode.
It is a very special episode.
So special, in fact, that we're going to open up with a Facebook message that doesn't really have much to do with this, right?
Nothing to do with the topic, but it was a Facebook message that I wanted to reply to. I didn't get to it, so I'm gonna cover for my error here in the podcast. And I want to read a message that comes from a Facebook user named Dawn Wheat. And this is from about a month ago, and I never got back to her, so I apologize for that. But I just wanted to read it here because it's a good note, and it's got a couple of good ideas in it.
Oh, cool.
So Dawn writes in and says, "Hello, I've wanted to write you guys for a long while and tell you how much I love your podcast."
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dawn. She says, "I'm a graphic designer, fine artist in Denver, and spend lots of time listening to podcasts. And I admit that I waited to last to listen to this one out of all the How Stuff Works podcasts."
Mm-hmm.
"The reason is that I'm the stereotypical female artist who thought that I couldn't understand anything about cars or that it would be boring. I was so wrong. I love the history topics that you guys have done especially. So this leads me to a question. How many of your listeners do you think are female?" That's a good question. I guess we really don't have any way of knowing how many listeners are female. We can kind of track that sort of thing on Facebook, you know.
Yeah, we can do like a rough demographic,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, something like that. But I would assume that it's a lower percentage than the male listeners, I would think. It's got to be a much lower.
Just historically, it would tend to be. I know when I've heard of stuff from other car shows, for instance. Mm-hmm. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, every listener is welcome. So
Absolutely. Yeah. So she continues on here and says, "Recently I met a woman in Denver that works with a car dealership and told me that she sometimes holds classes for women to learn about cars."
Cool.
"Now, you've touched on this from time to time, but what car owning tips would you give to someone who really doesn't know much about their vehicle?"
Mm.
"Second, as we chatted, she commented how cell phone technology is driving car technology, and in some cases, car companies are really struggling to keep up. I think this is fascinating, which is just shows how much I've gleaned from your show. Keep up the great work, and thanks for keeping me entertained and educated, Dawn." That is very nice, Dawn. Thank you for writing in. And those are a couple of really good ideas about cell phone technology pushing, or phone technology pushing, mm-hmm, automotive technology. That's a great idea. And also
car owning tips.
Yeah, best practices maybe.
Yeah. Car owning 101.
Yeah, that doesn't – I mean, okay, you're saying specifically towards women, but – I don't know, that kind of is a general thing. Like, there's a lot of guys out there that really don't know a whole lot about cars that maybe want to learn the very basics, the very simple things
right.
that you do.
I call them how not to break X kind of classes. Like, how not to break a car. I've been working with some of our friends here in the video department, which, you know, I've been part of for a long time, mm-hmm, off and on.
It's
a weird story. Yeah. But one of the things for a basic camera class that we would do, the actual name of it is how not to break this camera. And it's all the basic stuff. So if you just say how not to break this car, you can do a good job. One thing before we get into it, Scott, one thing that is exciting about that topic, both of them are brilliant, but the first one really sticks out to me immediately because you and I have read those studies that say, the younger generation, the so-called millennials, of which I am technically a part. Isn't that weird?
At the tail end.
I'm at the beginning, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Just let me have my moment.
I see.
No, I'm kidding with you, but the stuff we've seen has argued that as a whole, as a unit, people born in that generation are less likely to own a car, a little less likely to be interested in one. And I would question the methodology there, but I also think this is a great thing to give people because here in the U.S., you are required by state law to have some sort of qualification to drive a car, right?
Sure.
And we've done stuff about licensing and stuff, but people aren't required to have some sort of understanding of their vehicle beyond basic safety tips.
Oh, this is a whole can of worms, Ben, because I think that when you say something like that, a blanket statement, like some qualifications to drive a car, Oh boy, there's so many degrees of this. As long as you can pass that state administered test, you get your license.
Right, right.
And that's way different than it is in other countries, I understand. I mean, they make you tow trailers with loads that shift.
Yeah.
They make you do you have to learn standard transmissions, you know, as well as, of course, automatics.
You have to get they give you a puppy on the first day of driver's ed, and then at the end of it, you have to abandon it in the woods.
That's very,
just to show you can do that.
It's a difficult test. Yes, right. So, the requirements are so different, from country to country.
Sure.
State to state here in the United States is not all that different, but,
no, there are some exceptions for things like farming, early licensing for farming.
And the level that you take it now, I mean, we've talked about this in the past too, is that how I took it, and I think how you took it, if I remember,
yeah,
was through the school, mm-hmm, and it took me several months to get my license, and I'm talking like going in at 6 in the morning and staying until noon.
Right.
And the driver's test was several hours on the road each day after a certain point of that, you know, month and a half or
right,
whatever it was. It was a difficult process, but other people go to a driving school where they get their license in, you know, it seems like a week. Mm-hmm. It could be a little longer, but, you know, ballpark somewhere in there. So it's a much reduced time frame, but you still learn the same things. You just don't maybe get the immersion that you would in a class like that is offered through the school.
Well, there's so many basic things that could be added to that would make roads safer and make drivers more, I guess, independent, mm-hmm, you know, and not having to depend on someone else to help them. Like everyone should, I think, for part of a driving test, here's a basic one. Part of your driving test, the car you drive in to take the little obstacle course, you have to get out and change a tire.
That's a great thing to do.
That would be a great thing to do. You have to be able to name different parts of the engine. Open the hood. What's that? And you have to say, they're, you know, you have to name something.
Also smart, you know, name the fill points in your car. You know, like what are the serviceable items on the car?
Right.
We could go on all day about this, but I think we've gone off track. Dawn hit initially.
We have. Sorry, Dawn. It's just such a good idea. We're right away. We can't even talk about the cell phones pushing car tech yet. We should save that for an episode.
Well, either way, I just want to say thanks, Dawn, and keep listening.
Yeah.
We'll hopefully keep you entertained.
Yeah, yeah.
And educated.
And for everyone else, of course, our best ideas come from listeners. So the most important part of the show, to you guys. So if you want to take a page from Don's book and write in with a suggestion, we'd like to hear it. We're not the most punctual at times, but we do keep a list of stuff we want to do.
We definitely have a list, and the punctual thing, we do our best.
Yeah, we do our best.
We do our best. Okay, here's one that's, this one's from a few months ago.
Speaking of listener mail.
Yeah, Ben, and here's one that comes from a listener. His name on Facebook is Ratfink. And you gotta love that. That's, you should get extra credit for that name.
Yeah, two extra points.
Two extra points, wow. That's very arbitrary.
I'm very cheap with points. No, I'm kidding. You're right. It is arbitrary, which,
well, I'm giving him 50.
What?
His real name's Jake.
All right.
Jake goes by Ratfink. All right.
Okay.
So Jake writes in and says, I'm a huge fan of your show, guys. Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jake. That's another 5 points.
He says, I personally owned and was restoring a 65 Caddy and am now building a Cafe Racer. By the way, the Cafe Racer episode was excellent. From a Honda CB750. Oh, that's very cool. What
wow,
a cool project. I have a couple of show suggestions. You haven't done a show on Smokey Eunuch. He was a troublemaker in NASCAR and did many strange and experimental designs for Indy, including a car with a pod for the driver and an engine built torque the opposite direction for better oval handling. You could also do a show on Mickey Thompson, goes on with a couple other different things. But that is a fantastic idea, the Smokey Eunuch thing. And that's what we're going to cover today, because this guy is a real character.
Yeah.
Smokey Eunuch.
Oh, man. A legend. So much so that you'll often, when he is eulogized, you'll often hear people saying, we need more characters in racing. And they'll go, well, what do you mean when you say character? And then the inevitable reply is someone like Smokey Eunuch. So what we'd like to do today, let's see, Scott, what do you think? There's so much here.
Can I just point out one thing before
yeah,
we even start here?
Yeah.
When I say a character in racing, in NASCAR racing, I'm not talking about like the celebrity status that some of the guys have now, like almost like rock stars or something like that. You know, they travel around in the big motor coaches and
yeah,
they're flashy and they do all the news interviews and everything. It's not like that. And what I'm talking about is a character, like a real character, like somebody who challenged every rule, somebody who changed a lot of rules, somebody bent many, many rules, somebody who's involved right from the very beginning, somebody who almost, if you saw him at the track, he would look out of place. That's what, and I'll describe that in just a moment, but he didn't look like he belonged there really, which is kind of strange to say, but he really didn't. Much later in the series, I guess, maybe not initially. But he is almost like, everything that you read about him is almost sounds like a tall tale.
Okay. Yeah, there's almost this, because there's some Americana to it. It's almost like Pecos Bill, you know, or something like that.
Exactly. A lot of these things have achieved almost like legend status. And some of them, I understand, get embellished over the years. I get that. You know, that's kind of what you do with the story like that. And I'm going to dispel a couple of different things here today, maybe.
Hopefully, if we
mention them, because there's so much that we would need to get to regarding Smokey Eunuch, and if we don't touch on every single little thing, you'll have to forgive us for that, but we'll do our best, because this guy was, again, quite a character. He lived until about 2001. Mm-hmm. So from 1923 all the way through 2001, he was heavily involved in NASCAR in the very, very early days, and in IndyCar as well. Had his hand in drag racing a little bit, not a whole lot. But some of the stuff that he did influenced series outside of those as well. Can-Am, Formula One. It was just, he was an amazing guy, very mechanical, and that comes right from the very beginning.
Yeah, and even outside of racing, he was a well-known mechanic and inventor. He's got some patents as well. So let's start at the beginning, right?
We should start with his real name.
We should start with his real name.
His real name was Henry Eunuch. Now, the name Smokey came about a little bit later, which we'll get to in just a moment here, I promise. But his real name was Henry Eunuch, and it's not quite as catchy as Smokey Eunuch, is it?
No. It doesn't roll off the tongue like Smokey or Engelbert Humperdinck, for sure. Eunuch, that's an interesting last name. Some people might think, Y-U-N-I-C-K. And it is because his parents were from Ukraine.
You know what? I need to say it. When you first hear that, you might chuckle a little bit. With the different spelling.
Right. It's a very different thing.
It's a completely different thing. This is Y-U-N-I-C-K. So Smokey Eunuch, different name, different thing.
And I'll tell you, man, growing up, I heard Smokey Eunuch's last name before I learned the word eunuch. And I always thought, like, I didn't understand what a quote-unquote eunuch would be in that latter sense. So I thought a eunuch was, like, a fan of Smokey Eunuch for a few years until now, you know, I'm old, so we didn't have stuff I could Google at that point. So I went to the library and got a dictionary and then had my mind blown at a young age.
I bet, yeah.
I didn't understand.
Well, anyway, I just felt we needed to clear that up.
We need to clear that up, and now it's clear. So his parents come from Ukraine. He grows up on a farm in Pennsylvania. His father passes away when he is a teenager, when he is only 16.
Yeah, 16 years old. So he's left to run the family farm, drops out of school at this point in order to do that. And he was a mechanical, as we said, right from the very start. As many people will tell you, he took an old car, like a junked car, and created a tractor out of it. And I seem to remember listening to a bit of a documentary somewhere that said something about why he felt the need to create that tractor. And of course, you need a tractor on a farm, and this is a cheap, simple way for him to do that, and also a project for him. But I think there was something. This is funny. He kind of butted heads with a horse on the farm. A horse that was, you know, typically used to do some of the plowing and things like that.
Right, yeah.
And this horse and him did not get along. I don't remember the name of the horse now, but this is more out of spite against the horse than anything, I think, Ben. And he created this kind of ramshackle tractor out of this old junk car, just so he didn't have to deal with that stupid horse anymore. Because the horse would apparently, like, you know, ram him into fences and stuff like that. It was like a mean-spirited horse.
Which is true, as everyone knows. There are such things as mean-spirited horses.
Oh, okay, come on. It was funny though that, you know, like out of this this rivalry, this battle between the two of them, this man, you know, Smokey versus this horse, that he created a tractor out of it just to get around using it.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of the old story about the guy who invented the revolving door. The official thing, you know, revolving doors are very useful in skyscrapers, tall buildings, just because of the way they address pressure.
Sure. Yeah. Right? Oh, and in stadiums that require air pressure to keep the roof up.
Yes, exactly. However, this guy, I think his name was Van Cannell, Theo Van Cannell, I want to say. Hmm. Apparently the real reason he invented revolving doors is because he thought it was utter bunk that he should have to hold the door for women.
Oh, that's terrible.
He was like, he was so upset about it that he invented a different kind of door.
Oh, that's crazy. Which brings into question the etiquette for revolving door. Like, does the man go through first because that's the person doing all the pushing, or do you allow the female to go through first, which requires them to do all the pushing?
Technically, in a revolving door, the guy is supposed to go first.
Okay.
So
now we know.
Now all of us can overthink this when we go to the next revolving door.
We're off track again.
I just think we've run into a couple of very interesting things. So as much as he hated this horse, he loved motorcycles. He was building them and racing them, right?
Absolutely, yes. And he bought what was just kind of a simple, cheap, surplus motorcycle.
Right.
But I think it was an Indian motorcycle. I've seen some photographs of a young, very young Smokey eunuch on his motorcycle, and I saw an Indian logo on there. So I'm pretty sure he had a pretty cool bike. However, you know, he thought he was, as somebody said in one of these other documentaries, he thought he was the greatest tuner in the world at this point, even at that age. So he would tinker around with this thing, make it, kind of souped up a little faster than it should have been probably. And he took it out to the local track and would race on the weekends with this thing. And the announcer during his very first race when he brought it out, I guess he wasn't quite as good at tuning as he thought he was. Mm-hmm. And the thing smoked the entire race.
Which gave him a nickname, something a little bit better than Henry.
Yeah, because the announcer, of course, called him Smokey. You know, Smokey bringing up the rear, whatever it was. You know, and so he goes back to work on Monday morning or whenever. And so, you know, on Monday after, you know, this weekend of racing or whatever, his friends caught word of, you know, how the announcer was announcing him during the races. And the nickname Smokey just kind of stuck with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah. Even when he joined up with the Army Air Corps in 41, he was the pilot of a B-17, which, for those of you familiar with that, is often known as the Flying Fortress because of their size.
And he was young. He was only like 18 at this point.
Yeah.
Was 17 or 18, maybe 17 even at this point. So very, very young, but, you know, somehow advanced to the rank of you know, being a pilot for this B-17. And he flew over, Europe, right? He was in something like over 50 missions
right.
in Europe. And
yeah.
I think he was stationed out of Italy, but then he transferred to the Pacific Theater following VE Day.
Yeah. And, his group while he was piloting was called Smokey and his Firemen.
Smokey and his Firemen. That's a good name.
Yeah. He got out.
The Flying Tigers, right? That was who he's with?
Yes. The Flying Tigers, the famous Flying Tigers. He had flown for them. And after his time in the service, he eventually married in 1946 and moved to Daytona Beach, Florida, because he had flown over it while he was training. And when he noticed it from the air, he said, yeah, I'm going to make it to that place.
Beautiful place, right?
Beautiful place.
And it's warm. That was one thing that he always said, was it's beautiful and warm there. That's where I want to be. Probably a stark contrast to the farm in Pennsylvania, right?
Right. No
yeah,
kidding.
So this is a perfect spot for him to be. 1946, Daytona, which, now think about this. When did NASCAR form? NASCAR was formed in, I want to say, 1948. I think that was when NASCAR came. I have a note on that somewhere, but I believe it's 1948 when it was actually founded. But they were racing stock cars earlier than that. And team owner, his name was Marshall Teague, a local stock car race team owner, came over to Smokey, you know, because he had already opened this garage, which he called, I can't believe we skipped right over that. But he had opened a garage in 1947 that was called Smokey's Best Damn Garage in Town. And that is quite a boast, I guess, you know, to say that this is the best garage in town. But especially there with all the stock car mechanics and everything, you know, mechanical that was going on. It was a racing city, even then.
Right.
But it was right on Beach Street in Daytona, Florida. And he opened it in 1947. It stayed open all the way until 1987. You could have gone to that garage up until 1987 and seen Smokey hanging out there, you know, if it wasn't out on the race circuit somewhere.
But increasingly irritated with being there.
Yeah, well, he closed the doors on the garage in 1987 because he said there are just no more good mechanics.
Yeah.
Outright said, that's it, I'm done. I can't call it the best damn garage in town anymore because it's not, there just aren't any more good mechanics.
Which, you know, it's got to be a morale blow for the people working there at
the
time.
But you know what? Those people knew what he's like because this guy, overall, Smokey Unick is an absolute straight shooter. He'll tell you exactly what he's thinking and what he thinks about what you're doing. And I've learned that over watching, you know, many, many video clips of this guy, documentaries, reading about him. He just no holds barred. I mean, if he was thinking it, he would say it. And a lot of people really appreciated that about him. And it makes him just, again, quite a character in the pits, in news conferences or whatever happened to be. You know, anybody, reporters talking to him, some of the comments from this guy are just outrageous and they're funny.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got that kind of, off the cuff, he's candid, maybe a good way to say it.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And
a good way.
And in a world, you know, where often nowadays people speak with such careful filters and stuff.
Well, this guy was completely down to earth. He was salt of the earth guy. I mean, really, really, he was just an amazing character. And, his Motorsports Hall of Fame induction speech, you should listen to that if you got 10 minutes to spare.
Yeah.
That is, I can't even begin to tell you how crazy that speech is. It's so funny from beginning to end. It had me laughing out loud, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is pretty good, actually. So yes, 1948, that's when NASCAR is founded, which is a good segue for us to talk about Smokey's role in racing. So he's got the best damn garage in town, right? Mm-hmm. And this is still the era of good mechanics, and word spreads that he's pretty good. It spreads far enough, to reach a guy named Marshall Teague. And Marshall Teague at the time owns a stock car race team. And he says to Smokey, you know, come on, join up the team, join up with our team. And Smokey accepts, although he doesn't, he's never raced in stock car racing before.
Ah, that's the thing. But he says, you know what, that doesn't matter because Bill France, who founded NASCAR, he said he didn't know anything about stock car racing either. We were just doing what we knew how to do, which was build fast cars. Something in that general term. He said, we didn't know, I think his actual, phrase that he said was, none of us knew nothing at the time. None of us knew how to race a stock car. France started NASCAR, and he didn't know what the hell he was doing either. So, we were all kind of learning this game as we went along. And that's kind of the genesis of this, the Smokey legend is that, because he was there in the very beginning, the NASCAR rules were about one page long. That was it. It wasn't like this big rule book that, has all these stipulations and, asides and, annotations and all that.
So, caveats.
Yeah, exactly.
Fine print.
It wasn't like that. But a lot of those rules are in place because of Smokey. And so, they would go to a race and, if the rule book didn't specifically say that you can't do something, Smokey would do it. And then the next race, they would say, well, you can't do that. And they would add a rule. And he would go around that rule as well. So he wasn't breaking rules. He wasn't cheating. He was just simply going around the rules that were there. It's kind of that gray area, the reading between the lines in the rule book that made this guy what he is. But again, he's involved early, early on. And I think he built a car in 1948 for Herb Thomas, I believe his name was, the guy that drove the fabulous Hudson Hornet.
Yes, you were correct.
Cool car. That's an amazing car. And, that's part of NASCAR lore is the fabulous Hornets, fabulous Hudson Hornets. And Smokey was the crew chief for that team.
Yeah, and that was the Southern 500 in Darlington, and that Hudson actually won the race.
Yeah, now remember, this guy, he's self-taught. He's a mechanic, he's a builder, he's a crew chief, he's an inventor, he's also a designer, he's a racer, he's all this stuff, but he's for whatever reason, he's kind of got the magic touch with engines. He just seems to be that kind of guy, and he can look at something, a race car, and he can determine how to make that car faster or better, within the framework of the rule system. That is within the framework.
Because we have some things to talk about once that comes up.
Well, now that I'm saying within the framework, he's bending the rules. He's thinking way outside of the rule book, But then again, if it's not in the rule book, then you can do it, right? It's legal until they say it's not.
Right. Let's say that he helped define some of the rules.
That's okay. That's a better way to say it.
Because while we're talking about this, this is one of those legends that you hear about with him. And I'd like to go ahead and just talk a little bit about it. The old 7/8 story.
Okay. All right.
Do you want to save it?
Well, you know, that's one of the legends that I'd like to dispel, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do, too.
Well, I was just making sure that we're on the same page on this one, because there's the common belief that the 7/8 Chevelle is a real thing.
Right. And what we're talking about, some people may remember this, some may not, is that one of the big stories that always went around that you might have heard about Smokey Unick through the years is that he made a 7/8 scale 66 Chevelle. And that he raced it without NASCAR knowing.
Yeah, driver Curtis Turner, I believe, is his name. Number 13, right?
Right.
Black and gold.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this it turns out, is not true.
Not necessarily true. Now, he did some major modifications to that
car. He did. It is true that he took, three Chevelles, Scott?
I believe it's three.
So here's the thing. Of those three, the second one wasn't built by him. It was from Chevy Engineering, and then Smokey and some Chevy techs finished it there at the garage.
Modified it heavily.
Modified it so heavily, right? Mm-hmm. This car had 66 bodywork, even though it was called 67. So that gives some of the I think that's where some of the confusion starts.
Mm-hmm.
And the popular thing, the idea is that he just made this 7/8 scale miniature to cheat the NASCAR rule book.
Yeah, but as a lot of people have pointed out, if it truly was a 7/8 scale car,
right,
it would be so dramatically different in size.
So noticeable.
Yeah, it would be. It would be like a miniature vehicle out there on the track. Now, I know that sounds a little strange, but other people have said, you know, maybe it was a 15/16 version of it.
Right.
And that's not correct either.
No.
What he did was he took the hood and lowered it. So he modified the windows, modified all the pillars, you know, A pillar, B pillar, C
right.
pillar. What else did he do?
Right. Now, the aero mods weren't all super successful because he tried to smooth the floor pan, and that may not have been the best move. But here's the thing. Going back to your earlier point, 7/8 scale car would be around like 2 feet shorter than a regular version. There's no way someone could not notice that.
Yeah, that's a huge difference. And as far as you're talking about length, right? And then mm-hmm. height wise, it would be something like 10 inches lower than the other vehicle
right.
on the track. Because there were other Chevelles out there.
Yeah.
So they would see that immediately.
I mean,
would have stuck out
a sore thumb
to anybody.
Yeah.
The NASCAR officials would have found that. However, with his modifications, they were so slight and so cleanly done.
Yeah.
That's the thing about all of these things. They're so cleanly done that even, you know, during the scrutineering process for NASCAR, before each race, you know, they have to inspect every vehicle. The things that he had done to these vehicles were so slight and so perfectly done that really a lot of the stuff slipped through before they ever even found it. And then other racers would say,
hey,
you know what, I'm going to call shenanigans on what Unick's doing over there in his garage, because there's something about that car. Why is it so much faster than every other car out here?
So here's one example. What did get him in trouble in this famous Chevelle case was one of the things he did was he moved the body of the vehicle back on the chassis by about 2 inches. This moves the aerodynamic center of pressure a little closer to the rear. And that's one of the things that NASCAR was upset about.
Very clever. And is this the same one? I believe this is the one that even the, you know, the drip rails underneath the edge of the car, I think he moved those closer to the center. He did little things like that. Just
right.
little tweaks here and there that made a huge difference out on the track. The stuff that you just wouldn't think of, he was mm-hmm. thinking of.
And this is out of time, though. This is something that happened much further on in the story. I just wanted to give that as an example
mm-hmm.
of the, and some of the legends you hear about them are true, but that one just doesn't pass a couple basic tests.
All right. You know, there's a couple other things that I want to mention here, and I don't know if this specifically pertains to the to the 66 Chevy Chevelle, you know, the seventh ace car that we just talked about,
sure.
or not. This might be another smoky unit car, but there were ways that he got around qualifying regulations and things like that. So, and I think one, and this is just off the top of my head, this one, but there was a vehicle that he once qualified with fender skirts on the rear wheels. And everybody thought, well, that's crazy. What are you doing? You're not going to be able to, you know, they said, well, go ahead and do it. You got a
yeah.
slight aerodynamic advantage by doing that. But when it comes to the time to pit that vehicle, how are you ever going to get those rear tires off with those fender skirts in place?
Yeah.
And they were actually in place. It wasn't like, they just weren't cut out like the stock cars would be in the day for fast changes. And so he qualified it with those tires on and at that speed, you know, with the increased aerodynamic advantage, I guess.
Sure.
He qualified faster than everybody else in that car. And then when he got back to the pits, all he did was just cut the arches out at the track for the race. And people said, no, 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 you can't do that. You gotta, and he said, well, show me in the rule book where it says I can't do
right.
that. Right. You know, he says that, I'm allowed to cut the fenders. It just doesn't say when I'm allowed to cut the fenders. And I'm choosing to do it between qualifying and the day of the race.
And I mean, talk about how bedeviling that must be for the NASCAR authorities, but it's part of the game, honestly.
It really is. It's like this cat and mouse, that the game that's played all the time, and it still happens today. I mean, I know this happens. Some other things that he did, the way to get around some of these regulations, all right, he used 11-foot coils of 2-inch diameter tubing for the fuel line, which added about 5 gallons of extra fuel to his vehicles. Now, so he's carrying all this extra fuel because they had fuel tank regulations. It said
right.
it has to be this size, this capacity, et cetera. So they have him in the pits. This is another one of those, maybe a tall tale, right?
Yeah. But this one's a little more plausible.
Yeah. So this adds 5 gallons by adding those 11-foot coils of 2-inch tube, to the car's fuel capacity. So NASCAR officials, come to him on this specific vehicle with a list of 9 different items that Unic has to fix before the car is allowed on the track. And so the NASCAR officials have taken out, at this point, they've removed the fuel tank from the car and they say, we're going to inspect this fuel tank. Now, inside the fuel tank, they find a basketball, by the way, that's deflated. And then he would inflate it, for the, you know, the capacity. So
yeah.
the reach capacity. Then he would deflate it during the race and allow additional fuel to be put. But, so they've got the tank out and, they say, we've got 9 items we want to inspect this car for. And he says, fine. He jumps in the car, starts it up without a fuel tank and drives back to the pits and says, you better make it 10. So knowing that they're going to catch him with the extra fuel coils.
Right.
So this guy, I mean, again, unbelievable the way he goes around these things, because they don't say anything about an inflatable device in the fuel tank that you're not allowed to do that.
His approach is, I mean, it's super hair splitting, but the assumption is, which I do see some validity in, the assumption is entirely on the letter rather than the spirit of the law. Anything that is not explicitly forbidden is clearly permitted.
Yeah. And as he said, all the other guys out there were cheating 10 times as much as we were. That's how he put it. He said, you know, it's not just me. I just happen to get the bad rep for it.
Yeah.
So he would do things like, he also built other cars too. And we'll get back to NASCAR in just a minute, but he also built a 68 Camaro for Trans Am Racing, and he set a few speed and endurance records with this car, like out at Bonneville and, you know, other places with different engines, but it never won a race while he owned it. And then he sold it to a guy named Don Yanko, and, you know, people probably know the Yanko name, you know, modifier, car tuner, I guess. And with Don Yanko, the car went on to win several races, but the car superficially looked like a stock, you know, Camaro from the day.
Ah.
The 1968 Camaro, but it wasn't.
Yeah, it was only superficial. This was so clever. So they dipped the body panels in acid, and they used thinner windows. So although it looked the same, its weight was reduced.
Now, that's an old drag racing trick.
Right. Yeah. That's an old school gag.
Yeah, it is. But to incorporate that into Trans Am Racing, that was something brand new for them.
Right.
And not only that, he did other things too, right?
Yeah. The windshield was at a more laid back angle. The front end was tilted downwards and all 4 fenders were widened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He also moved the front suspension higher and lower, and the floor pan was moved up to lower the car, and then just a lot of other things. Now, this is the one that had the drip rails that were brought closer to the body.
Oh, yeah.
For just a slight aerodynamic improvement, but just unbelievable. And some of the stuff that he included as well, like there was a connector to the engine oil system that was extended into the car's interior,
yeah,
which would allow the driver to add oil from a pressurized hose during pit stops. So the driver was doing that during pit stops.
Mm-hmm.
Saved a lot of time. And in order to allow the driver enough freedom of movement to do that, the shoulder harness was modified with a cable ratchet mechanism from a military helicopter. So, again, not just limited to engine modifications and aerodynamic stuff. He was thinking about all aspects of this. You know, like, how can I save time in the pits? I'm going to let the driver do some of the things that he normally would do.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Let's see what else. I'll just go back to racing real quick.
Sure.
So between late 50s to the early 70s, he was also in Indy 500 racing.
Yeah, what, 53 through 70, or 58 through 73, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, I think that's
through
right. 73. Yep. And he won the 1960 race, but here also, and you might even argue more importantly for the sport overall, he came up with some various innovations, right?
Yep.
The one that always sticks out to me is the reverse torque special.
Oh, this is so cool.
So this is the engine running in the opposite rotation.
Mm-hmm. Very smart. It spins opposite so that it drives you into the corner better because you're making left turns at Indy.
Yeah.
So this rotation assists you in driving into the corner harder, you know, at a higher speed, rather than the rotation that kind of throws you off balance or out of the corner.
This
is, all it really is, I mean, when you think about it, marine engines do this. They have, if you have a boat that has twin inboard motors, one spins one way, the other one spins the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the case with this, is he got the one that spins the opposite direction. It must have been a marine motor that he used in this, or something similar.
Right.
Well, he probably cooked something up himself. But
he had some other stuff.
You mentioned he won in 1960. That was with driver Jim Rathman at the wheel. So he was crew chief, obviously.
Yeah, he was crew chief.
And it was a much different time at Indianapolis than it was now. You know,
yeah.
Didn't have these cushy RVs like you had. He said a lot of times they were sleeping on cots in Gasoline Alley.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just not the same type of thing. You know, you'd spend 24 hours there at the track working on these things, you know, overnight. They called Indy his mistress because, he would visit there every May and that was it. He would just spend the month of May in Indianapolis with his Indy team and then he would go back to the NASCAR circuit because that was his main thing. He had 57 wins and 2 championships in NASCAR. I think the championships came in 1961 and 62. You know, and while we're talking about his NASCAR record,
yeah,
with the championships in 61 and 62, prior to that, he had raced for other teams. He was in Chevrolets in 1955 to 1956,
yeah,
Fords in 57 and 58, and then Pontiacs, 1959 through 1963, and that's where his championships came in. But I apologize, Ben, I derailed you from your Indy car talk.
Oh, no,
here.
Come on.
So let's get back to some of the innovations in IndyCar, because aside from the reverse torque special, there were a couple of other strange things that he came out with.
Yeah, it's Scott, of course. But before we go, you know, that's how I always know when it's going to be a good topic is because we have so much to cover. We're just going to have to jump in with stuff as we remember.
I know it's kind of scattered, but you know, here's the way we're going.
So let me do some of the, we'll talk a little bit about Indy, but then I have some almost completely unrelated facts.
Sounds great.
Okay. So he also invented the Hurst Floor Shifter Special. And this vehicle had the driver's capsule mounted what they call side saddle.
This is the weirdest thing
ever.
It's
the weirdest thing.
It's
pretty weird.
It's
in 64, by the way.
1964. And do yourself a favor and go to the Googler and, and search Hurst Floor Shifter Special to see a very or highly unusual Indy car from 1964. It's almost like looking at a motorcycle with a sidecar, but the driver, the rider,
is in the sidecar.
Yeah, it's just the strangest looking thing. And that pod, I guess, Indy officials hated this thing.
Yeah, of course they would.
The side pod thing was somehow connected to the chassis of the vehicle with only 5 bolts, I think.
Right.
That was it. But the control was over there, and there were innovations even within that. I mean, there was like a squared off steering wheel that gave mm-hmm. him more knuckle room, I guess,
yeah.
in the driver's pod. Of course, the Hurst shifter was, you know, prominent on the right there.
Uh-huh.
But the engine, the fuel tank, all that other stuff was on the other side of the vehicle and all extremely well balanced, and it remained well balanced throughout the entire race. So
mm-hmm.
no matter what load of fuel you're carrying, it was an extremely well balanced machine.
Yeah. And another thing about this, the next thing he did. one of his other big innovations. In 62 with Jim Rathman, again, he designed a wing. He mounted a wing on the Vista Special Watson Roadster. This wing allowed Rathman to reach corner speeds that no one at Indy had ever seen before. But when this is the thing, it wasn't perfect because on the corners, it was awesome, right? But on any non-cornering area, it increased drag so that the lap time overall was lower.
Yeah, and Indy is a 2.5 mile oval. So this is a long distance where you're going, you know, on the straights, and it was detrimental to the vehicle. But he had a great idea, and it's hard to imagine an Indy car today without wings. I mean, they're loaded with wings. There's wings in the front, there's wings on the sides, there's wings all over
days.
The place, everywhere. But prior to that, they didn't have them. And when you look at where he placed that wing, it was immediately above the driver, almost like I don't know if you've ever seen the World of Outlaw cars that have kind of that flying nun wing on the top.
Yeah, it allows
them to corner at like 120 miles an hour on dirt or something, super fast. But that wing placement is similar in that it's right above the driver on these great big struts.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
Just because I never get to use this word.
Okay.
That flying nun thing that you're talking about in a nun's habit.
Yeah.
I think the word for that is wimple.
A wimple, really?
Like dimple, but with a W.
Cool.
I may be wrong, but this might also be my one chance I'll ever get to use that word in conversation.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, I'm just going to act like I didn't just brag about it, and I'm just going to pick up right where you left off and like, so like a wimple, right?
Oh, fair enough. Like, just like, and I'll pretend as if I knew it, and I'll say, just like a wimple, Ben.
Just like a wimple.
All right, so just like a wimple, and
right,
this is on Rathman's car. And the thing is that USAC, you know, the United States Automobile Club, USAC, they immediately banned the use of wings, of course, you know, as they would. But they soon began to appear on other series, like in the Can-Am series and in Formula One. Prior to this, you know, prior to 1964, no one was really using wings like this until Smokey Unick put them on an Indy car. And then around 1970, USAC started again to allow the use of wings on their race car.
So
they're back in Indy. But it took this six-year gap of other series using them. So imagine, you know, Can-Am series without wings or Formula One series without
wings.
It is, because it gave them such an advantage in the corners. It allowed the racing to be so much faster.
And can I do a little bit of trivia just while we're in this area?
Of course.
All right. So this is strange, but it was pretty interesting to me because Smokey Unick was kind of a Renaissance man, and he did a lot of stuff that maybe people didn't know about. I think I may have gotten the number wrong. I said 9 patents, but it was probably more like 12 patents.
Yeah, I've seen numbers between 7 and 12.
Okay. Yeah, because I hadn't completely nailed down the ones. But he did a bunch of experimentation, right, mm-hmm. with things like alternative energy sources and synthetic oil. He also invested in mining and petroleum extraction in Ecuador, of all places.
Got to diversify.
Got to diversify your bonds. And he actually owned a hotel in Ecuador. And after every Indy 500, he would go there for a month and just chill out.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's the story.
That's fascinating.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, you mentioned patents and innovations. Well, he's got patents, U.S. patents, on several things, on variable ratio power steering. The extended tip spark plug is his invention. Reverse flow cooling systems, high efficiency vapor carburetor, a claimed high efficiency vapor engine, which never entered production. And he installed that engine on a Pontiac Fiero, which is still around somewhere. It's hanging around somewhere. But this vapor engine ran on an extremely lean air fuel mixture, something like 50 miles per gallon for this thing. It was around 1984. It's a unique story. I think, you know, some of the bigger magazines, I don't know if it's Road and Track or Car and Driver, but they had some articles about this vehicle it was interesting what he was working on. And I think it might have worked, but there was a few hang-ups with it. It wasn't exactly perfect yet. He was working on it, and it just never came to fruition.
Yeah, it didn't come to fruition, but that's the nature of invention so often.
Of course, yeah. So he's got this kind of prototype Fiero hanging out there somewhere, but I don't know who has that right now.
And if you are listening, and you have this, Fierro, feel free to write into us. Another thing that might surprise people, certainly surprised me, was that amid all of this, all of these innovations, this full-time racing, mining in Ecuador, he also found the time to become a regular and rather popular columnist for Popular Science.
Well, sure. A lot of people had questions. And he had a column, I think, that was called Say Smokey.
Uh-huh.
And people would write in and say, like, I got this question about, you know, my truck's not working correctly. What's going on? He knew all these power secrets and engine tuning tricks. And he could answer just about anything that anybody brought to him, even if it was just a question, you know, that they had typed and, you know, sent him a postcard or whatever. You know, you got to remember the day this was. It's fascinating, you know, that he would have the time to do something like that or would even want to do something like that. But I think it speaks to his character that, you know, he's also, you know, just a mechanic. He wanted to help people.
Right. He it's weird, though, that he was such a prolific writer because that wasn't the only magazine that he wrote for. He also wrote for Circle Track.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he published some candid pieces about his disagreements with NASCAR.
Yes, yeah, he wasn't always on the best terms with Bill France, you know, through NASCAR. And in fact, one of the reasons that he left NASCAR, he had a driver. His name was Fireball Roberts,
mm-hmm.
and Fireball Roberts had a crash in 1964 at Charlotte Motor Speedway, where he kind of, this is awful. The guy, you know, he had a crash where he suffered severe burns, and he kind of lingered on for about 40 days before he died. And he was a good friend with Smokey, of course. You know, he's one of his team drivers. But Unic began a safety campaign for modifications in NASCAR that would prevent some of these things from happening. You know, Jackie Stewart did for Formula One.
Mm.
Smokey Unic did a similar thing, but he was a crew chief, not a driver. But as a crew chief, he said, "Well, I can show you a few safety modifications that will prevent a lot of the stuff." And he was overruled repeatedly by Bill France Sr. And as a result, you know, all these back and forth arguments he had with Bill France Sr., Unic left NASCAR in 1970 and didn't come back. Now, he also supposedly designed what would be the first safe barrier. Now, I think there's other arguments as to what the safe barrier is, but
right.
Here's his design. He had two pieces of plywood with tires in between, like reused tires, I guess.
Right, yeah.
And that is officially the first safety barrier that he, or first design for a safety barrier that he proposed to NASCAR, and NASCAR said, no, we can't go with something like that. And they kept the concrete walls, and they kept them for a long, long time until they went with something they call the safer barrier,
right?
Which is, of course, you know, modern version with foam and all that. But arguably, his design with, you know, the plywood and tires was a first movable surface that would have prevented a lot of potential NASCAR deaths during that time. And I know you've got to add an asterisk to that. You know, you could never really be sure, you know, what deaths could have been prevented, you know, it, you know, looking back, you know, hindsight.
Sure,
but,
yeah.
But I'm just saying that this would have been maybe a safer version of that. And he said the same thing, and a lot of other people did, but he got a lot of pushback from NASCAR at the time.
Well, also, you know, part of their job is to proceed very cautiously with those, any kind of changes to the competition.
Oh, that would have been a major change, too. I mean, you're going from a concrete barrier that keeps, you know, the cars away from the fans to, you know, adding this safer barrier. Now, it probably would have been added outside of the concrete barrier, so it would have, shrunk the size of the track effectively, you know, the width of the tracks.
Right.
But, still, it was a design that he came out with, and then later there was a version of that which is similar in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of suspect.
A little bit. Do you want to talk about it some?
No, that's all right. No, that's okay. I don't need to go too much into that, but you can dig into the birth of the safety barrier and see what you find.
Right. Well, this is not to say, of course, that Smokey Unic is unrecognized for his various innovations. In fact, as you may have heard us mention toward the top of this, he is in the Motorsports Hall of Fame, of course. He is one of the first 20 people inducted in its inaugural year. He is also in the Motorsports Hall of Fame of America. As you know what, if we want to just go on, he's in like more than 20 different halls of fame.
On and on and on. And also he, of course, there's Smokey's autobiography, which he wrote.
Sex, Lies, and
Super Speedways.
Super Speedways, yeah.
And that was read, the audiobook version of that was read by his good friend, John DeLorean.
Yeah, that's weird, too.
Isn't that strange? And it wasn't just, you know, that autobiography. He also wrote a book In 1984 that was called Smokey's Power Secrets, which, of course, a lot of people really wanted to get their hands on at that point. And right around the time when he passed away, just prior to that, I think he had realized, like, well, you know, I'm already getting kind of old. And, you know, he didn't yet have the diagnosis of cancer, which he didn't know was coming. But it kind of abruptly took him at the end. But he had already, you know, many years prior to that, started gathering up these stories of, you know, times at the track, the birth of, you know, NASCAR, some of the forgotten folklore, I guess, of the
right.
sport
yeah.
and of his life and, you know, looking at it through his eyes. And he had this kind of loosely assembled group of stories that I think he took it to an editor and said, you know, I need help putting this all together, but
right.
I want it written as I would say it. I want it, you know, and he had mostly done that. The editor just simply, you know, worked on transitions and how to kind of smooth out the stories, I guess, to make them work together. But he put together this group of it became much more than it initially started out to be. It was just going to be one book. But there was a book called The Best Damn Garage in Town. And I say book, but it's really a three-volume box set.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1,100 pages long, Ben, with over 400 photographs. And it was sold in two different versions. There's the Racer's Edition that sells for $95. And then there's also, if you can get your hands on this, you should, there's also a signed, numbered, hardbound collector's edition that's currently not available, but I'm sure you can find them out there from some collector somewhere. Now, the funny thing about this is, it weighs that group that I just said.
Yeah, the three volume set.
11 pounds is what this thing weighs. This three volume set. It's huge. It's an enormous collection of stories. Now, there's also a smaller version. Right?
Yeah, I was going to say. There's good news though. If you say $100, 11 pounds.
Yeah, 1,100 pages. I don't have time to read 1,100 pages.
What the heck, you guys? And you would like to have an abridged copy. I think you can get one that's around 800 pages for $30, and it weighs 4 pounds.
Yeah, 4 pounds. They call that the pocket edition.
That's the pocket edition.
Yeah, can you believe that? So, anyways, it's really, really, it's funny in the way it's written. And I've read excerpts from this. I haven't read, of course, the whole thing yet or anything, but I've read excerpts from it. I really would like to get my hands on it.
He's a good writer. He can make you laugh out loud, which is a gift.
He definitely can. And I mentioned that speech. There's a you can go to SmokeyEunuch.com. There's kind of an official site and the launch site. And there's a section that is videos of Smokey. And, of course, there's clips from, you know, a documentary that was done about him on Velocity Channel, I think. And then
right.
there's a speech that was given by him, and I think it was from his Motorsports Hall of Fame induction. And I mentioned that early on in this podcast, but it's about 10 minutes long. And it is hilarious from start to finish. It really is. He's a funny guy. And you know, as we said, you know, when early on I said, you know, he didn't look like he might belong in the pits at Indianapolis, right?
Uh-huh.
What I was meaning was a lot of people, when they saw him, they thought, well, look, there's some farmer has wandered onto the Indianapolis 500, you know, pit area. Because that's the appearance that he had. But they said, you know, if you look at him carefully, he was really – he was thinking about things. He was, you know, if they only knew what was going on behind those eyes, I guess.
Right.
He was constantly looking at things and trying to find ways to adapt and change and to better the race cars that were at his disposal there, you know, his team. And a lot of people just took his outward appearance as being someone who, you know, maybe he wasn't quite as slick as the other guys, the other crew chiefs, the other teams.
Sure.
But he was, I don't know how to put it, Ben. I want to say that he was... He was a very thoughtful guy, but he was also, you know, kind of funny to be around. He would come up with sayings and things that, you know,
sure.
stick with you. And he was just an all-around good guy, but very down-to-earth, very salt-of-the-earth guy.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, also I think there was the fact that he was completely unpretentious, you know, and he was not afraid to call out an elephant in the room or to point out something. I think he took great joy sometimes in skewering BS, for lack of a better phrase.
Absolutely. He's walking around and he's got cowboy boots on, a beat up old hat.
Corncob pipe.
A corncob pipe. I love that part. Yeah. He would walk around with a corncob pipe. That's funny. I mean, but it was kind of a trademark of his. And after a while, people just knew who he was and knew what to expect out of him, knew what he was capable of.
Right.
And that's what's important. I mean, this guy was really remarkable and his whole lifetime, really. I mean,
sure.
His accomplishments, you know, the way he changed racing. I'm trying to think of anybody that even matches, you know, this type of character now. And I've only come up with a few. I can't think of anybody right now that stands out to me as like a master mechanic, like this guy. Like if he touches it, he fixes it.
I'm drawing a blank. I'm sure there are people, but I don't think they have the same almost celebrity appeal. You know, they're not as well known.
Well, the closest I can come, and now this is a little bit different, but I think like AJ Foyt or somebody like that. You know, he's quite a character, and he was a mechanic as well, and he was gifted as a mechanic, but he was just an outrageous character on the track.
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking like, other racing names that people know that aren't kind of like the modern rock star celebrity type, racers. But what about like Mario Andretti or something like that? Now, he's not a mechanic. He's not anything like that, but he's a household name. You know, people know who Mario Andretti is. But I think maybe AJ Foyt is about the closest I can come. There's, of course, Junior Johnson.
Sure.
You know, I don't know. There's a few out there, but. Few and far between.
And none exactly on the same level.
Yeah.
To be honest. Just because of all the combination of stuff in one person. So, of course, as you could tell from the way we've been speaking about this, Smokey Unick passed away after a long battle with leukemia. However, his legacy still endures because he's kind of inextricable from racing. You know, because he futzed with the rules so much, because he was the one guy crazy enough to do those extra gas coils and then say, well, what if I just put the driver in a sidecar? You didn't say I couldn't. He is one of the biggest reasons that, even if it's almost a devil's advocate position, he's one of the biggest reasons that racing is the way you see it today.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to show you his character. You know, towards the end when he was given this relatively short amount of time to live after he got the cancer diagnosis, he went about repairing some of his equipment, some of the engines, some of the tools and stuff that he had around his shop still. And he said, you know, the reason is I want this stuff to go into the hands of somebody who will use it, somebody who knows how to use it and will do something with it instead of, you know, being placed in a museum somewhere. As he said, he didn't want some high roller to get a hold of it or, you know, some big conglomerate to just buy the whole thing and put it in a museum. He said, I want somebody, to actually be able to use this. And it was auctioned off, after he had passed away.
Yeah.
But he had taken the time to go back and make sure all that stuff was in working order so that whoever got it could actually use it. I think that says a lot about his character.
Yeah, I think it sure does. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode, Jake. Your score of bonus points remains at 57.
Again, very arbitrary.
Very arbitrary. You know what? I'm gonna add an extra few. How many should we add?
26.
All right, 26. So now you have a grand total of 83, sir. 83 completely arbitrary points at your disposal, accepted at, possibly numerous locations in your area.
Yeah, car stuff locations worldwide.
So let us know what you're going to spend those on. In the meantime, we didn't get to everything, but we do have to mosey on out of here. So again, thanks for the fantastic suggestion. Listeners, if you have a suggestion, hit us up on Facebook and Twitter where we are Car Stuff HSW, and you can see shows that for one reason, well, you can see things that for one reason or another might not make it to air in the episode. Because we're always digging in and finding interesting stuff. You actually found a fairly ominous thing about Tesla. Because we're digging in and we find interesting stuff, and that's where we put it. You can check out every episode we have ever done on our website, carstuffshow.com. And Scott, if people want to write to us directly, where should they send that letter?
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.